Big East Preview Pod. 2 weeks from college basketball, we sit here recording this, and we wrap up our conference previews today, Brad, which feels very out of the blue, right? I mean, I look around. There's lots of secret scrimmage results to react to this past weekend. I was enjoying it. I was enjoying me and you were sending lots of trilly tweets back and forth about such results. But it does feel weird to say, all right, yeah, here we are. This is it. And we close with a conference that we talk about quite a bit on this podcast, the Big East, obviously the conference home of your favorite team, Brad, the Providence Friars. But lots to get into throughout the conference. How are we doing, sir? I know you have an exciting technological advancement to announce on the show today.
Well, I got a new pair of headphones.
Yes, the headphones have been a...
Believe me. Now I can't say that I've never spent money on this podcast. There goes my profitability ratio. But first, in regards to the Trilly tweets, the one that caught my eye the most is oh, nothing to see here. UCLA was just without their three best players. Two of which are presumably eligibility issues. And Bona, I thought he was healthy. I guess he's not healthy yet.
His shoulder is not quite back to health from what I've gathered.
I mean, we're at the point where if guys aren't – guys like Mawat Mag or the bigs for Texas, where it's like, all right, there's 2 weeks until the season. Like, are these guys going to be ready to go for the start of the year? And I think I didn't realize that Bona's in there. And we're still waiting on eligibility stuff with Mara and Bearkay. So that was a eye-raising little note on a Trilly tweet. And then for previews in general, I really don't like the preview. It's kind of a double-edged sword where on one hand, like without the previews, we would just be talking about the same teams over and over. So it like allows you to or like forces you to not talk about Louisville for 6 weeks, right? Or not talk about Providence for 6 weeks, right? But at the same time, there's some teams where you just don't have a strong take on it. And that's kind of like a consensus too with some teams like Oklahoma or LSU, where it's like they added all these new pieces. Like, are we going to be a tournament team? Like, no. Why not? Basically comes down to because I said so.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. But at some point you just have to dig in and have a take. Like I think I've been generally like a pro Oklahoma guy all spring, all summer, and I think I'll continue to be, although they do have an injury that is worth monitoring. Another per source, another JV and McCollum concussion. I believe that's six in the last like 3.5 years. So hopefully he is back to health soon, but that's something to at least keep an eye on. But yeah, it's a fun time of year. As you said, the UCLA thing is kind of eyebrow raising. There's a lot there's a lot of stuff that's still in flux. I mean, you talk about three of the most important international players in the country, and Burke, Buyutinsel, Ade Mara, and then Zvonimir Ivicic of Kentucky, all three seemingly still floating out there from an eligibility standpoint. You have transfer waivers still certainly floating, although we got a big one on Raekwon Battle here to just today. That's something that we'll have to keep track of. Obviously, some of these guys are still under appeal, and we saw in football a few of those appeals get granted. So not a lot of clarity.
Battle got denied.
Battle denied for now, but appealing, maybe that'll get cleared eventually. But yeah, it makes it difficult, especially if you were trying to fire up BovadaSportsbook.com and see if you could profit off some of these preseason futures. It's very tricky, but we will try to do what we do best, which is give you a preview of the Big East, which I think we've been talking about all year, Brad, but this thing is going to rock.
See, at least it's definitely the most entertaining, but you know, diving in and doing these previews, I feel very strongly that the SEC is the best conference this year. And I feel that the Big 12 with a stronger middle/bottom is probably ahead of the Big East too. So I think the Big East is probably third best conference coming up this year.
Yes. I don't necessarily disagree that the Big East, like top to bottom, is not the strongest conference, but from a pure entertainment value, as you said, I think it's far and away number one. First of all, you have some like intriguing returning players, right? you know, that's more than some leagues can boast.
Yeah, probably the best individual talent of any conference. Right. Doing a top 100 player, I had like 21 or so Big East guys out of 100.
Right.
And I kind of ran by a few. Okay, here's five guys. You know, pick one guy out of this group to you. Not telling you that I was trying to cut Big East guys or anything. And you know, the first one I gave whatever. KJ Simpson and, you know, few of those type of guys, and Cam Spencer. And you were like, oh, you got to have Cam Spencer there. I was like, oh, that's another Big East guy. And I did it again with Tristan Newton. He's like, oh, you got to have Tristan Newton in the top 100 as well. So I was like, all right, we have like 20 Big East guys in my top 100 players.
Yeah, I mean, the talent's great. And the top tier teams look really good, right? I think because we're both higher on Villanova, which we'll get into here as to why later on, there's four potential top 15 teams here. And then you add in Rick Pitino at St. John's. You add in Sean Miller at Xavier. You had a very talented roster at Providence and the brain of Kim English. The real ones understand that reference. You add in the juice of is Georgetown returning? You know, the Georgetown-Providence game that's going to be one of the most hyped of the year, regardless of its implications. Like, it's just going to be pure theater. And I think that's what I'm probably most excited about. Excited to go to a lot of Big East games this year. Hoping, obviously, beyond my Marquette and DePaul travels, I'm going to hopefully get to I'm planning on going to Georgetown-Providence in Providence. Also planning on hopefully going to St. John's at UConn right before Christmas. That could be a very entertaining game. So it's gonna be a great year for the league. I'm excited about it. Shall we get into Marquette, Brad?
Sure. And I guess
yes.
I just have a bone to pick with a lot of the Marquette discourse at issue. And we mentioned this probably this point a couple months ago, but everyone is just hand waving the Omax departure. Oh, they're bringing pretty much everybody. Like, dude, Omax was 6'8 with this incredible wingspan. He played 3 through 5 at his time at Marquette. Yes, David Joplin is an offensive upgrade, no doubt. David Joplin could lead the team in scoring. David Joplin's a very good player. He's more than capable Big East starting four man. But for a team that struggled on the glass and is not super athletic, you're going to take your most athletic player out and put in an offense first guy that's going to make the defense and rebounding even worse. I mean, I don't see how we're hand waving that. Everyone, oh, they're just missing Omax, but you know, who cares? No, like Omax is really good on both sides of the ball.
And so just to take our step back here, right? The big picture with Marquette is that they're coming off a 29-win season, won the Big East regular season and tournament, go to the second round, lose to Michigan State after the injury to Tyler Kolick, dealing with the hand issue that really bothered him seemingly against Michigan State, bring back, as you said, four starters, but not five after Omax went to pro, and didn't add anyone in the portal. Now, they did go out and get from the freshmen a couple of key pieces. Guys who I think are probably blocked from playing too much right away just because of the realities of this team bringing back eight of its top nine. But you look at Trey Norman, Al Amadou, and Zaid Lowry as three potential rotation players moving forward. And in all, a program that is very, very healthy under Shaka Smart. They're recruiting at a high level. They seem to be very, very comfortable in the types of guys that they're recruiting. Guys seem to be happy to stay, right? There was no real overtures to the NBA for Igudaro, Cam Jones, or Kolick. Not that they would have had necessarily great options. None of the bench guys transferred. Like, it was a very smooth offseason. But as you said, they do lose Omax. And I think there's the point you made, Brad, that is Marquette lost a versatile defender who could make shots, who is low maintenance, who is athletic. There's also the point I think that probably hasn't been made a whole lot, which is that Marquette last year was probably a little bit better than the sum of its parts, right? It had good players without a question. Like Tyler Kolek, great point guard. Cam Jones, really good wing. Iguodaro, really, you know, outstanding passer and big man. But I do think if you look back, you said, all right, this is a team without necessarily like a true pro, and that Omax sort of changed that, but like without like a true dynamic pro. And it's a two seed, and it beat the defending champions in the Big East regular season by two games and in the conference tournament.
Yeah, I mean, at this point,
some regression tied to that.
I don't think regression from a talent level standpoint. I'm just concerned about the defense and the rebounding. I mean, at this time last year, the conversation we had is I said, okay, this is a tournament team, but they're going to be square on the bubble, and it's because, you know, can Tyler Kolek be a best player? You know, basically last year I was saying, okay, I really like this top like six or seven guys, but it's a bunch of kind of complementary pieces, kind of role players. And I thought one of the guys who could make a big jump scoring was Stevie Mitchell, because that was what he was billed as a high school player. But we saw Kolek made a huge jump at point guard. Oso made a huge jump at the five. And Cam Jones went from being a spot-up shooter as a freshman to like a dynamic three-level scorer. Yes. He's like an incredible finisher. Every time he shoots, you think the ball's going in. So I think when you take a step back now, it's clear that there is a ton of talent here.
Well, like, in retrospect, right, I mean, they got like the 99th percentile outcome for every guy on their roster last year compared to preseason consensus.
Yes. Yeah, I think I'd say that.
Tyler Kolek becoming one of the best point guards in the country after the previous year averaging like 7 points per game and shooting like 35% for the field was like a 99 percentile outcome.
Cam Jones, definitely. Yeah.
Right. Cam Jones for sure. Oso. I mean, we went from, oh, we like his game to like, holy cow, look at this.
And I remember you were like, I mean, no one was talking about Omax as a draft pick. And you were like, I think he's a two-way guy next year. And that was like a crazy take, and he ends up going, what, 20th, 21st?
Yeah, it just kept going. Yeah, you're right. And I do think the one thing for Marquette that does get overlooked when you're looking at teams to run it back is that there is some room for internal growth, right? Like, just like last year. I mean, the minutes and opportunity might not be quite as there, but, like, Chase Ross profiles very favorably as a breakout guy. He was top 50 in the country in steal rate. You know, he was efficient driving to the basket. He's athletic. He can play multiple, you know, guard spots. Like his numbers compare relatively well as a freshman to a lot of the guys you think of as like a true breakout type wing. Ben Gold had some nice moments. Sean Jones is a pest, right? Like the opportunity, and obviously Joplin, who will have all the opportunity, can really score. So, you know, I'm inclined to believe Marquette should be like a top 10 level team. I do worry, right? Again, sometimes just a team has a little bit of an extra it factor. They had that last year. Will they have it again? But like, they're still going to be a nightmare to guard because they share the ball so well. They cut so well. I think we talked about this on the show in the past, but there was that great, there was a great tweet by Cam Jones mid-year where one of these draft Twitter guys posted like, oh, what a savvy, you know, backdoor play run by Marquette and Shaka Smart. And it was like this clip, you know, backdoor. And Cam Jones quote tweeted it with like, not going to lie, we was just hooping. Like, it's just like the perfect, like these guys, like they just had like they had a smarts and a high level of basketball IQ that was, you know, really hard to teach. And I think that really, really helped them. I will say they were also like absurdly efficient offensively, particularly on twos, right? Like you look down the line, Tyler Kolek shot over 50% on twos. Cam Jones, a 6'4 wing, shot 64% on twos. You know, even like Stevie Mitchell was 55 on twos, Chase Ross, 57 on twos. Like everybody really was efficient for two. The only guy who wasn't was David Joplin. That's because David Joplin takes a lot of like step backs and like tougher shots. So, you know, I like the balance here. I do think, as you said, the defense, which was already somewhat of a concern last year, could be even more of one. They're going to be, I think, even more reliant than they were a season ago on forcing turnovers. They're going to have to be better on the rebounding front. But this is going to be a really fun team to watch and a team with a real chance to win the Big East again.
So I think, yeah, I'd say probably the most, you know, kind of like what you were saying earlier, the biggest areas for growth, right, is that this bench could be really good, right? Because the only guys that they lose from last year, right, they lose Zach Reitzel, the forgotten portal man who has been erased to history to push the Shaka doesn't use the portal narrative while their best player is from the portal, Tyler Kolek. They lose Amarian Ellis, right, who was hurt last year. And then Kian Ejiofor, who was a reserve big who followed Shaka from Texas. He was a Texas signee.
Yeah.
Right? So they kind of cleared off the back of the bench. And the minutes that Ross, Gold, and Sean Jones got last year are going to pay huge dividends. Specifically Ross, who most of the time I was watching, I'd rather have Chase Ross in there than Stevie Mitchell.
I agree with you.
he was hitting corner threes. He's super athletic. He's a little bigger than Mitchell, although I have seen some people suggest he could take over the Omax role. I don't think he's big enough to play them. I mean, I guess he could. Well, here's the question. You know, when David Joplin's out of the game, who's playing the four? Are you sliding up Oso and playing Ben Gold at the five? Are you giving Lowry a chance? It looks like he's probably 10th in the rotation. He's a very athletic shot maker. Going smaller with Chase Ross. What do you think they do there?
I think playing smaller. I will say I also think Trey Norman has a chance to crack the mix here.
Yeah, I think he's 9, Norman.
I agree. Yeah, 9, Lowry's 10, and then...
Ross 6, Gold 7.
Yeah.
Gold, you know, he didn't play a ton last year, but he hit shots. He didn't look out of place at all. He competed. So I think he's in for more minutes this year, and probably... the easiest way to do that, right, is to play him and Oso together. So
according to the sports books, Marquette is like a clear tier two title contender. I think if you look around, you'll see their odds somewhere between like 7th to 15th to win the title. Same tier as like Tennessee and Houston and Creighton. You know, UConn's right around there as well. Given that, Brad, would you put money from your Bovada account on Marquette to win the title?
No, I'm again the rebounding, the athleticism, the defense has me worried. I have Marquette slip into 12th.
Okay.
Third in the Big East, 12th overall. Which is probably around where they were in Kempom last year, so maybe it's about even. But again, this offense is going to be incredible. It's worried about size and athleticism up front.
I'm 7th nationally, 2nd in the Big East, 1 spot behind UConn, who will be our second team to preview today. Actually, it won't be because we have to go by the Ken. Actually, no, we're just breaking the rules. UConn went 13-7 in the Big East last year. 2nd, they won the national title. They ripped through the NCAA tournament. You all know the story by now. Remarkable start, weird, bad middle. That included like a few moments where you're like, holy shit, like this is actually falling apart. Like the St. John's and the Seton Hall games were like, oh my gosh, like they are not that good anymore. Started to turn it on down the stretch, lost that close game to Marquette, and then just torched through the NCAA tournament. Every win by double digits, all by 13 or more, average win result, I believe by 20 plus. I mean, it was a romp for UConn. They do lose a lot. You know, you look at Sonogo, obviously, Andre Jackson, who you'd argue is their most important player, Jordan Hawkins, their best shooter, even some of the role players, you know, Joey Calcaterra, Naheem Aline to the portal. So it's a new look group, but I think the hope at UConn would be between the Klingon explosion that's impending, the portal addition of Cam Spencer, the freshman and Stephon Castle, and then just the consistency and the level that they've recruited, right? You talk about Solomon Ball and Jaden Ross, two of these freshman wings with tremendous athleticism. Samson Johnson, who was all the hype at this point last year, then got hurt and never really saw the floor. Diarra, like the whole is that this top nine really doesn't miss a beat, and they still have one of the best rosters in the country. And I think I still agree with that, but it does rely on a strong, healthy season from Klingon, a consistent season from Newton, and Castle living up to the billing, which is that he is one of the five best NBA prospects in college basketball this year.
I mean, all right, I guess we'll start with Castle.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he has to be incredible. Like, the way this team's set up, right, where you have Klingon, who I think is going to be a monster. I think he's going to be an All-American. I think he's the best player in the Big East. Last year, I mean, everyone who watched, and maybe UConn fans will push back on this, but everyone who watched was like, this guy's better than Sanogo. He scares you 10 times more than Sanogo does. My wife even said that when we were watching, we were at UConn Providence. Like, why doesn't the tall guy play more? He's killing us. I mean, he is going to be an absolute monster. And then in the backcourt, you have three guys, right, with Newton, Spencer, Castle, that can all dribble, pass, and shoot. They're all guys who could average, you know, over three assists a game. They can all hit threes. They all have good size. And then Caravan at the four, you know, he was pigeonholed into a stretch four role last year. Thrived. But he's got way more game than that. You know, he can post up. He can attack off the bounce. He's more of a scorer than he showed last year.
Yep.
So I think if Castle comes in and averages, like, 10 points a game and three assists and shoots it okay, takes care of the ball, I think UConn will be in great shape.
So first on Castle, the narrative from all the, like Gavoni is super high on Castle, there's been a lot of preseason buzz, whatever, has been like how great he is. I think I saw a Matas Buzelis podcast appearance where he said, like, you know, the number one player he believed in the class should have been Stephon Castle. I watched Stephon Castle three times last year on the circuit, three different games, three different days. No time did he overwhelm me by any stretch. But he also, like, actively played bad in all three of those games, like, to the point where you felt like he was getting a bad rap or that I was his, like, bad luck charm, because he was smoking layups. Like, he couldn't do anything right. It was kind of unbelievable to watch. And I say all this to say that sometimes the narrative's influenced by small sample sizes. Maybe the small sample size for Gavoni is really good. The small sample size for me is really bad. The truth is somewhere in the middle. The truth is Gavoni. The truth is me. I don't know. Right. That being said, I do think there is a substantial burden on him, because I think we saw last year with Cam Spencer, what he is he's a very good shooter. But he's not dynamic, right? They don't have someone who's necessarily dynamic in this backcourt if he's not, right? And when you think about all the things UConn did last year to put pressure on you, all the sets they would run, the speed, the athleticism, the execution, it required having dynamic dudes. And I think they need Castle to be that, because Caravan, great player, not that. Newton, very good, but inconsistent. And Cam Spencer, again, not a dynamic player, not a speed guy, not a guy that's going to be like bolting around screens the way that Hawkins was and getting open in a fraction of a second. I mean, remember, this team was top 10 in the country in assists per field goal made last year. Like, they shared it at an elite level. They took a ton of threes. But they did all that. You hear that and you think, oh, a team that plays really free-flowing basketball. They did that running a set almost every possession. And I'm very curious to see who emerges around Klingon as, like, that dynamic presence. And I don't know that they necessarily have that. Now, they should still be very, very good at the rim. But I wonder if they will be quite as overwhelming at the rim without Jackson. Right, because Jackson put pressure on the rim all the time. He was an unbelievable offensive rebounder. He was an unbelievable shot blocker. Right, that spot, like, if you're replacing Andre Jackson with either a freshman or Cam Spencer, I guess you'd call Spencer the Hawkins replacement and Castle the Jackson replacement. Like, when you're replacing a guy who was a just absurdly dynamic in every way, rebounder, defender, ball handler, like everything he did. I think that's going to be a really hard thing for this team. And some of the advantages that they created, they won't be as prevalent. But
so I think.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Otherwise, well, I think the upgrade on the defensive end, right, from Sanogo to Klingon, right? Klingon's going to give you more shot blocking presence around the basket.
Right, but they were already top 10 in the country in two-point defense, unless we're projecting this to be like an all-time great two-point defense.
Well, I mean, I don't know how people view Purdue, but shouldn't this be comparable, if not better, than Purdue's?
It should be better because Klingon's more mobile than Edie, yeah.
And then Samson Johnson, we'll see if he can actually play. I mean, the fact that he didn't redshirt last year after that foot injury was a disaster. Like, he only has 2 years of eligibility left now. But, yeah, we have to see if he can actually play besides the preseason glowing reports. But, yeah, I agree that, right, Castle is on the defensive end is not going to be Andre Jackson, who was a top 0.1 percentile, who could fly around and be super versatile. And he probably won't be as good as Andre Jackson in transition. But in the half court, he should be significantly better offensively. Like, part of the UConn struggle last year was that they weren't even guarding Andre Jackson.
So that is where I would disagree. Well, not even disagree necessarily. When UConn was bad, Andre Jackson was one of the reasons why. He wasn't the only reason, right? The shooting was inconsistent.
Right. They just couldn't make open shots. They got in their head. They didn't have their coach for a game. It was bizarre.
But when they figured it out, Jackson was an unbelievable weapon offensively in the half court because he could screen, he could cut, he could sit in the dunker, right? Like, think about, you go through game by game in the NCAA tournament, all the ways the teams try to stop them, right? Like, against Gonzaga, they would send all the double teams on Sanogo, and then you would just see Jackson cut to the rim for dunk every single time. It was like clockwork. So I guess maybe it's just depending on like which UConn you're thinking of or which UConn you're remembering. But I will say, like, I think they're going to take a bit more of a step back offensively than people realize, because it's going to be really hard to replicate the pressure on the defense that Hawkins and Jackson put on you. That being said, I say all this to say that I'm picking UConn to win the league. It's fun. We've spent so much time across the offseason on these teams that I feel like I'm getting deeper into my bag of discussion. But like, it's very funny to me that, like, I'm sitting here being like, well, you know, I actually think UConn is, you know, this and then and then. But like, I do think they're like the safest bet to win the league because they're very, very athletic. They have the point guard, they have the center, and at this point, like, Hurley did such a magnificent job. I'm very curious to see what's next, but I think in the interim, I think you have to feel really good about Dan Hurley's ability to get the most out of this team.
And it's kind of funny because Dan Hurley, I don't think gets, even after the championship, doesn't get seen as a great coach. Okay. Like, I think, you know, like you look at like Scott Drew and Tony Bennett, who recently won their first titles. And maybe because there was more of a build-up where like Baylor and Virginia, they got to the elite regular season level and kind of flirted with March success first before breaking through. So you had that discussion, oh, is Scott Drew a good coach? And then most people, okay, yes, he is a good coach. And then he wins a national championship. Okay, he's a great coach. Same with Tony Bennett. Whereas Dan Hurley went from this guy can't win in March to snap your fingers. UConn was a dominant force.
Well, so we haven't had the real test of whether a guy is considered a good coach or not, which is a questionable roster. This roster is very good. Everyone would consider this a top 10-ish roster, right? We need UConn to have a year where they have, like, two top 75 recruits penciled in to start and, like, a weird transfer take at center. And then we can look around and be like, well, you have to trust Dan Hurley, and then we'll know he's a good coach.
Yeah, we need Braxton Key to be their best player, playing the three.
Do you have UConn as the best team in the Big East?
I went back and forth, but I put them fourth nationally, second in the Big East. I put Creighton first and third nationally.
Wow, Creighton, the top five. We'll get into them in a minute. But I guess, again, same question here. Same general range. That second tier title contenders. Are you interested in trying to bet on them as to bet on the repeat at Bovada?
Yeah, I mean, this starting five, like doing a top 100 players.
Yeah.
I left off Caravan because I was like, you can't have all five UConn starters in here. Like, he could easily be a top 100 player. They could have the whole starting lineup be like this could be the best starting lineup in college basketball. That's not out of the question. Duke, you know, maybe. That'll depend on Jared McCain or Ryan Young. Corver gets that fifth spot. But, like, top to bottom, this starting five is balanced. It's experienced. It's got shooting, creation, a monster in the middle. It's got it all, and I think that the defense should be pretty good. And then that's not to mention that this bench has some interesting pieces. We mentioned Sampson Johnson. Supposedly, Jaden Ross has been really good. Supposedly, Solomon Ball has been really good. Diarra was in the rotation for most of last year. Stewart got a lot of buzz as a recruit. I haven't heard much about him since getting to UConn. I think he was hurt in the summer. So bench has some upside too. But again, having UConn fourth means I think that they're in for a one seed.
Yeah.
That'd be a pretty awesome year.
100%. All right. Let's do Creighton, since you mentioned them. You have them as a top five team. Then we'll get to Xavier, who was second in the league a season ago. But Creighton, 14-6, Elite Eight. Unbelievable accomplishment, obviously, for the program. The year, I think on the whole, you would consider it living up to the preseason expectations. It was so weird, right? They looked great in Maui. All of a sudden, you have the Kalkbrenner mono issue, and all of a sudden, it's like, oh my gosh, Creighton stinks. The most disappointing team in the country. They're 6-6. What are we doing? And then you looked up the rest. You're like, actually, no, that they're really good. They were really good the whole way. They were a top 15 team the whole way. They had some favorable matchups in the NCAA tournament, but, you know, a bounce away from the Final Four. And had they gotten to the Final Four, maybe they could have pushed UConn. I'm not convinced, but if there was a team that could have handled the rim, it was Creighton with Kalkbrenner. They did have some portal departures with Nembhard and Kaluma both heading their separate ways, but considering what this offseason could have been, I think you consider it a win that Creighton got back three starters: Shireman, who takes the COVID year, Trey Alexander, who comes back after probably being a projected second-round pick. He should be one of the best guards in the Big East, and then Kalkbrenner, as we mentioned, the most indispensable player in the country, as we saw last year. He is a huge difference maker on both ends of the floor. His efficiency is sky high. His ability to protect the rim is incredibly valuable. It's a reason why Creighton was one of the better two-point defenses in the country. They also didn't foul. They didn't give up offensive rebounds. All of that because of Kalkbrenner. His number is really, really high across the board. Top five in effective field goal percentage, top 10 in offensive rating, top 10 in two-point percentage, 6% block rate, on-off numbers. I think they were like something stupid, like 30 points better per 100 possessions against top 100 opponents. Like, the list goes on. So you bring back those three guys. You add in Stephen Ashworth from Utah State, who I think there's a reasonable case to be made. It's probably more dynamic than Nembhard. Maybe not as good, but certainly more dynamic. And this Creighton team is getting a lot of steam. In fact, a lot of places, you know, you can make a bet on them as the favorite to win the Big East, which I was a bit surprised by, but maybe not floored.
So first, I think Nembhard is better than Ashworth. I think Nembhard's probably a better fit with this team. I think most people say Ashworth is a better fit. I think this team might be missing someone who can get to their rim. I guess the hope is that Trey Alexander develops that, but he's been more of a shooter. Now, why I like Creighton so much to put them so high and to have win the Big East is with Alexander, Scheinman, and Kalkbrenner, you have like three borderline All-Americans, right? Like Kalkbrenner transforms your defense.
Yeah.
Scheinman as a year two transfer, again, like a guy who can dribble, pass, and shoot from the wing. You know, he had a good year last year. And I think the fit will be a little easier now that you have a – the fit will be easier for Scheinman having Ashworth and Alexander in the backcourt. I still think that you would rather have Nembhard as your starting point guard, but to lose him and get a guy like Ashworth, you can't complain about that.
Right. So, I mean, look at it this way. Ashworth is a senior who averaged who was the leading scorer and shot 43% from three on a top 20 offense in the country last year that got an at-large bid. And Nembhard was not like a great defender, so it's not like you're taking a huge step back. Ashworth is not very big. He's not very athletic. He's not quite like a Joe Girard defender, but it's not going to be great in the Big East. And that's probably the number one concern, right, is that especially if they're going to play Isaac Trout some at the four, which I think is probably going to be more Mason Miller, maybe even Chandler Lawson at that spot, they're not going to have a lot of resistance on the perimeter. It's a good thing the Kalkbrenner's back there defending the rim, because they're not going to stop many guys dribbling off the bench, taking you off the bounce. But, man, are they going to be hard to guard. Like, if they're going to play Ashworth, Shireman, and Alexander together as shooters, and then throw in, like, a Mason Miller floor spacer at the four, they're going to be a nightmare to defend.
So I would ask you, am I being a hypocrite where I said, oh, Marquette fans are hand-waving Omax? And I'm saying, okay, Creighton, you can hand wave Arthur Kaluma. Now, Omax is a much better player than Arthur Kaluma. But Arthur Kaluma, for all his offensive faults, was an excellent defender. He was a great athlete, and he provided something different to this Creighton lineup. Mason Miller is a very good athlete, but I don't know if he's the defender or the versatile, kind of switchable, lockdown wing defender that Kaluma was.
I think they miss a Kaluma-style player more than they miss Kaluma.
Kaluma on offense was just so painful. I mean, we said it throughout the year. Like, if he's taken more than two dribbles on a possession, it's over. Just go down on defense. I mean, the decision-making was very tough, and he didn't shoot it well enough with how quick of a trigger he had at times. So I guess that'll be an interesting storyline to follow, both how he does play in the wing at Kansas State and how Creighton looks with a lower usage Mason Miller, but giving up something on the defensive end. And I guess looking at the bench, right, Farabella was not good enough last year. Frederick King, I thought, was pretty good when Kalkbrenner was out, but obviously they lost every game. So maybe I need to look a little closer there, but I think he's a nice long-term piece. And then Isaac Trout was a great recruit. Jonathan Lawson can really shoot and is pretty versatile. So I think the bench is undoubtedly improved from last year, and the starting lineup should be good enough that, barring injuries, they should be fine. But I guess the main reason why I'd say Creighton over UConn is, while I think Klingon is better than Kalkbrenner, Kalkbrenner is one of the best bigs in the entire country who can transform your defense. And I like Trey Alexander and Baylor Shireman better than any guard on UConn.
Well, I mean, in that case, why don't you fire up Bovada and see what a See if you can get some profit there.
Do we have so we're thinking, or is this out yet? Like, that UConn has UConn and Marquette have better odds than Creighton? Is that right?
No. Creighton and Marquette are the favorites right now in most sports books.
And UConn's third. Okay.
Third, yeah. But
so UConn has the best value.
I would guess that UConn will be picked first in the preseason, them or Marquette, and then Creighton third.
I mean, I'm sure every Creighton fan is thrilled about last season. Yeah. But, man, what a missed opportunity that was.
Could have at least went to the title game.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's move on to Xavier. And then we will continue to work our way down. Xavier, 15-5 last year, 27-10 overall. Great first year under Sean Miller. The offense, spectacular. Sule Boom, terrific. He figured out the front court, got Jerome Hunter going. Nunji, great year. Like, all things you could have really scripted out for Xavier went right. Ended up getting bounced in the Sweet 16 to Texas. But it just, like, has been a strange offseason. I think if you looked at it on June 1st, you would have said, all right, Xavier did what it needed to do. It got two outstanding guards in Davion McKnight and Quincy Oliveri. It got a big man in Abu Usman to give them some interior might that they would have lacked otherwise. But then Jerome Hunter and Zach Fremantle both down with potential season-ending injuries. Sounds like both will be season-ending. Hunter dealing with a cardiac incident. Fremantle's foot not healed from previous surgery. Both huge problems for this team. I mean, there are very, very few teams in the country that can withstand in any way, shape, or form, oh, shoot, we lost our two, you know, arguably our two best players and are just fine, right? Like, it should hurt them a lot. Now, that being said, I had projected this team as a tournament team. So when I saw the secret scrimmage result that they lost to Notre Dame, I very seriously considered aborting mission.
Yeah, I moved Xavier down from 41 to 47, which put them from an 11 seed to the first team out. Because, yeah, once Hunter and Fremantle went down, I was like, you know, maybe they could get creative, play Claude at the four, you know, maybe Dalen Swain plays some four, you know, and they're more, and they're smaller and it's more dynamic offensively. But I was listening to a Xavier podcast that didn't sound like Abu Usman was lighting the world on fire and their viewings of him and practices and stuff. And then when I saw that score of the Notre Dame game, I was like, okay, I think we can call it. This is going to be a dumpster fire defense. Like, offensively, they'll be fine, but I think the drop-off from Jerome Hunter to Gaitis Namiksa at the four is going to be...
I've got Stefanovic, but yeah.
Djokovic?
Oh, yeah, Djokovic, yeah. Sorry. Same difference.
Yeah, either way, it's going to be rough defense. I mean, Fremantle is not a good defender, but he would have given you, you know, what, 15 points and eight rebounds at least. Sean Miller figured out how to deploy the two bigs last year with Nunji and Fremantle. So the fact that they're either going to be playing four guards around Usman and Enzi or, you know, one of these European four men, seems like the defense is going to hold them back.
I agree with you, partially just because they'll be young and unproven. And most of these guys, like, if you look at, like, McKnight and Oliveri's track record, neither of them have been a part of any good defenses either.
I mean, Davion McKnight was that Western Kentucky team has 7-5 shot blocker, and they stunk on defense, and they stunk at two-point percentage defense. Like, I know this isn't the SEC pod, but I'm never sold a player more than I've sold Jamarian Sharp. Anyway, go on.
So looking at the positive with Xavier, the positives, you have two very good mid-major guard transfers. You have a breakout guy in Desmond Claude, and you have Trey Green, who we have both agreed is, like, he's that four-year college basketball point guard is going to be really, really good. And his stats and some of the early season stuff or early preseason stuff have been really impressive. I think it's pretty easy to buy, like, they're going to be able to score the ball in the backcourt. But as you said, the defense is a concern, the front court a concern, and just, like, they have one guy who's really done it in the Big East, and that's Desmond Claude, and he was, like, a rotation player who's never asked to shoot. Like, that's a huge adjustment.
And it seems like Cam Kraft isn't going to give him much of anything. He was hurt all summer. Swain's not a shooter. He's kind of in that Colby Jones, Najee Marshall kind of mold. I think more of a long-term, maybe next year we'll be talking more about Dalen Swain. But yet, if they could just get back one of Hunter and Freemantle, I mean, probably preferably Hunter. Shore up that defense, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen. I have Xavier 7th and just missing out on the NCAA tournament. First team out.
Yeah, I have them 7th as well, missing out on the tournament. I had them in until that Notre Dame scrimmage.
Yeah, I do. I mean, listen, there is no, not even the most ardent Micah Shrewsbury supporter would argue that this is a good Notre Dame roster. Right? And like I saw a Xavier fan on Twitter saying that they lost to Vanderbilt last year. Like, yes, but this Notre Dame roster is unfathomably untalented. If they do anything this year, if they come in 14th place this year, Micah Shrewsbury is skyrocketing up the coaching ranks. Anyway.
No, yeah, like if Notre Dame is good this year, either like they have multiple of just like the most stunning breakouts ever, or like something happened.
They're starting small forward, Tay Davis, or at least the guy who I think is going to be their starting small forward, was the 8th best player on Seton Hall last year. Their best player, Julian Roper, was what, the 7th best player on Northwestern last year?
Yeah.
And Kemba Jai was, what, 6, 7, or 8 for Penn State last year. So yeah, enough on Notre Dame. I mean, it's going to be That'll be another interesting one to watch. Anyway.
But so I have Xavier 7th and yeah, in the 50s nationally. All right, moving on. That brings us to Brad's Providence Friars. Providence 21-12, 13-7 in the league. But the big story is Ed Cooley off to Georgetown, oft in coaching rumors. Finally he moves. Seems like the Providence fans have fully embraced Kim English, the young, brash, exciting head coach, former Missouri player, former NBA draft pick. He did a nice job in retaining the current core with Bryce Hopkins and Devin Carter. Also secured as the word for the commitment of Garway Duel. Who had been committed to Providence but not signed under Cooley. But I do think if you look around, outside of the Josh Aduro addition at the 5 who follows from Mason, they did not do a ton to really build out this roster. There is a confidence seemingly in the returners, whether that be Jaden Pierre or Corey Floyd or Rafael Castro, although it didn't seem like there was a lot of confidence in Castro. This is kind of more happened by happenstance. That those guys can develop. And that calculated risk will determine whether this is a successful year one for Kim English or not in Friartown.
So, I mean, yeah, we should start with the moves, right, where he really wanted a backup 5. Like, he started on Graham Ike. He tried Zach Clemens. He tried Lance Ware. It seemed like he had Lance Ware until a late Villanova push with some extra dollars. He obviously got Will McNair. I think he tried with Zubi Ejiofor. He tried with, like, Sumto Cyril. They were going to try to reclass him. Like, everyone under the sun. And then it seems like Castro played pretty well overseas, and Will McNair thought he should be starting or something, and now I get my wish, and Castro can get some backup center minutes. But I think back on course here, you had derailed me by letting me talk about Castro.
Yeah.
But so this top 8 is an Ed Cooley top 8. Not even counting that if Ed Cooley were the coach, 6 of the 8 would be here. Like, Josh Aduro is such an Ed Cooley player. Like, he's like the prototypical, exactly what Ed Cooley wants in the center.
Yes.
And Ticket Gaines is exactly what Ed Cooley wants in a wing. So this is like literally a dream Ed Cooley roster, which is part of the reason why last February when Trilly floated Cooley to Georgetown, I didn't believe it, because I was like, you know, this is a really talented group. You have to start over at Georgetown, and this is a 100% an Ed Cooley roster. Yet Kim is talking about all the three pointers they're gonna shoot, and that has me very worried. Now, I wasn't able to attend the inter squad scrimmage, but I guess the three pointers were flying, and that has me very concerned.
So, I guess I'll say this. On one hand, I do think they will shoot more threes. I do think that they empower their guys. But Kim said they would shoot a lot of threes both years at George Mason. And one year he did shoot a lot of threes, and one year he did not shoot a lot of threes. He has generally played to his personnel. And I think he will continue to do that. I think the biggest thing is, right, they're going to say, okay, like, Josh Adura, if you're open, take a three. Bryce Hopkins, take threes, right? Like, we're prepping you to be a pro, whatever. Like, none of this, we're not taking mid-range jumpers. We're not doing this, we're not running the flex. I know that Cooley didn't actually run the flex, but everyone said he ran the flex. You know, there's going to be a little bit more like free-flowing ball screen stuff, I think, for them. And that's going to put a ton on Jaden Pierre and Garway Duel, right? Because Devin Carter's a very good player. And while Bryce Hopkins might be able to invert and handle the ball a little bit, they're going to have these guys do it, right? There is no like safety valve option. There's no like bench backup point guard who ever played 20 minutes a game at a high major. There's no like, oh yeah, if all else fails, right? It's these two dudes, good, bad, and different. So, you know, I have no real concern about it because I've seen them play. I think they're good enough. But when you do look at the rest of this league, right, and you say, all right, UConn's going to start two fifth-year guards. Creighton's going to start Stephen Ashworth and Trey Alexander. Marquette's going to start Tyler Kolick and Cam Jones, right? St. John's is going to start Danis Jenkins and Jordan Dingle. Villanova's going to start Justin Moore and TJ Bamba, right? Even Xavier's going to start Davion McKnight and Quincy Oliveri, right? Like, all the experience. And then to go out there with a freshman and a sophomore is a challenge for this Providence team. It's the one thing that holds me back from saying, yeah, like, this is a real sleeper to win this league. This is a team that I'd sprinkle at 20-1 if I was a gambling man over at Bovada to try to get this done, right? Like, to me, like, I would be interested in this team as a sleeper to win the Big East if I just didn't feel like they're too young in the backcourt compared to their peers to do it consistently 99 out. Doesn't mean they won't have a good year. Don't mean that we'll make the tournament, whatever. I think they will. But I do think you have to look up and say, all right, a little bit of concern day to day with how these guards handle it.
I'm not worried about point guard play whatsoever. Not one iota. I mean, you look at some of these great backcourts last year, like Trey Alexander and Ryan Nemhard were sophomores.
Yep.
I mean, Jordan Hawkins was a sophomore.
They had played way more basketball, but yes.
Yep. Marquette, Cam Jones, Stevie Mitchell and Tyler Kolek were all younger, you know, on the younger side. So I'm not worried about the backcourt at all. I mean, Jaden Pierre and Corey Floyd were both good last year. You know, this isn't like, you know, like with Castro or, you know, some of these younger guys where, you know, maybe they were good recruits, but when they got on the floor, it was just they were too young, they were too overmatched. Like, Jaden Pierre and Corey Floyd were both good last year. And now people, when these guys, you know, average 7-8 points a game this year and are starting or wherever, playing 25 minutes a game, people are going to try to tell you that they're surprise players. Don't let them. That's not a surprise. Jaden Pierre and Corey Floyd were good last year.
I don't think they're going to say they're surprise players. They're going to credit at Cooley. That's what they're going to do.
Probably. But Cooley wouldn't play Pierre last year. You know, he wanted to go with Bynum. And when Bynum got hurt, he went with Breed at point guard because he's so risk averse. But even Corey Floyd, who when he committed last year, like, he's behind all these guys, Noah Locke, Devin Carter, Allen Breed. Like, is he even going to play? Like, I hope he doesn't get discouraged and transfer. By the end of the year, he forced his way into the lineup. Like, everyone, including Cooley, was like, all right, we got to play Corey Floyd. And he was playing a decent amount down the stretch. So I think that those two sophomores are going to be good enough. They're going to be a good Big East starting backcourt. And then if Garway starts for Corey Floyd or Pierre, I mean, all of the draft people have Garway as like a first round pick. Some even as high as like a top 10 pick. So KenPom has his defense as being pretty bad. There is no way that a defense with Garway and Devin Carter and Corey Floyd is going to be bad. I don't care about the front court at all. Like, people who haven't seen Garway, like, he is an incredible defender. He can do weak side blocks as a guard. He can block jumpers. He just steals the ball from everybody. He is, like, an incredible defender. Devin Carter, we saw it last year. I mean, even Pierre and Corey Floyd and Ticket Gaines should all be good defenders. So I'm certainly not worried about the defense. The only things I'm worried about are the three-point shooting and the coaching.
Yeah. No, I think that's reasonable on all fronts. Like, Garway is a – I remember I went and saw Garway play. And you and I were texting. And I said he was kind of like a Marcus Garrett type. And it seems like people believe his offense has caught up to the point where he's more than that. But, Brad, like, defensively, the concern is really not there. As long as he's giving effort, he's going to be an impact defender because he is super rangy. He has good instincts. And he's just an awesome athlete.
I mean, he can just get into the paint on the offensive side. That's where the draft people are, you know, more in on him than like Marcus Garrett. Plus, he's a really good passer. The shooting, we'll see. It seems like the shooting is actually okay. It was thought to be bad, but it might actually just be solid. So that'd be huge for his draft stock. We haven't touched much on Devin Carter and Bryce Hopkins. I mean, Hopkins, the three-pointers, I'm actually interested in him shooting more threes. Last year, the issue with Hopkins was he dominated the early part of Big East play, just attacking every time. They stopped calling the fouls, and he wasn't getting to the free throw line as much. He was turning it over, forcing it more. And you would sit there and be like, he's open right there. Shoot that jumper instead of plowing into the lane. So I'm cool with Hopkins shooting more threes. Devin Carter.
He didn't shoot 36% on nearly 30 makes last year. He's not a broken shooter, but his game is bully ball for sure.
Yeah, his shot was a little stiff. But like Devin Carter, and I know Corey Floyd shot it well last year, but I would want to try to get these guys to attack the rim more, and you know, maybe more spacing will allow for that. But it seems like him is kind of in the same mindset of Dennis Gates, where it's like, If you catch a strike, let it fly.
Yes.
But Devin Carter is probably one of the more underrated players in the country because he's an elite defender and he averages 13 points a game on offense. And he's playing the three at 6'3", and he's, you know, he can guard any wing in the country at 6'3". He's that long. He's that athletic. He's that physical.
Yep.
And then on the offensive end, he puts in double figures.
So I have Providence 35th nationally, 6th in the Big East. I remember you have 5th in the league, right?
5th and 28th, yeah.
All right. Let's move on to Villanova. Villanova 17-17, 10-10 in the league. Weird year. Kind of a, you know, narratives galore, right, from this. If you wanted to come away with, all right, Kyle Neptune's a terrible coach, it's never going to happen for him, the post-Jay era is screwed, you could have come away with that narrative, right? I don't think he managed this year well. You know, the Whitmore situation was odd. The flow offensively just was not very Villanova. I think the clearest way of illustrating that would be their assist rate as a team last year. They were 286th nationally in assist rate. That is a ton of ISO ball. And that is not Villanova. I mean, if you look back, they've been relatively consistently top 50 or so under Jay. Now, they were a little bit less of that in 2022, but a lot of that was, yes, you have Justin Moore and Caleb Daniels. Like, they had opportunities to isolate, but they did even more of it last year. And it was hardly recognizable at points, but they combined heavy ISO offense with really only having five players, and one of whom was hurt for much of the year, and more that you really like trusted offensively. They had too many zeros, right? They had Armstrong was struggling. Archie Diacono was really, really struggling. Housen was really not much of anything for you early on. Longino wasn't anything offensively. Like, they just had too many black holes, and they solved it, right? $3 million NIL budget, got the best roster money could buy. TJ Bamba, Tyler Burton, Hakeem Hart, Lance Ware, all from the portal. Bring back Armstrong for year two, bring back Dixon and Moore, and hope that they're, you know, healthy and ready to go. It seemed like Moore will be. He was better, I think, down the stretch, Brad, last year than you probably would have anticipated coming off the Achilles, right?
Justin Moore, yeah, definitely.
I mean, go ahead.
Well, so last year in the preseason, I assumed no Justin Moore the whole year. And I said, this is still going to be a top 10 team. Because I loved Mark Armstrong from FIBA. I thought Cam Whitmore, well, he probably put up the stats that I would have guessed. He didn't really have the impact that the stats suggested. He was kind of lost in the ISO ball. We had Daniels and Dixon and even Archie Diacono were doing the 15 dribble back downs. He didn't really fit in with that. And then I thought Longino was going to be good. And even before the injuries last year, he wasn't living up to that. Once Whitmore was announced to be hurt, I thought he was going to come back sooner than he actually did. And it just killed their depth. And it put them in a hole that they couldn't recover from. You know, Angelo Brizzi was a disaster. Archie Diacono was good on defense, but offensively wasn't enough of a threat. Slater didn't take a jump that I thought maybe he could. And, you know, a lot of people love Eric Dixon. I'm not an Eric Dixon guy. Maybe it's my, you know, guard should score, bigs play defense in me. But his defense isn't very good. He can shoot. He can really score. But last year, I felt like he was kind of killing them, especially early in the season with a lack of defensive effort.
Yes. They just didn't have an identity last year. They felt like a team trying really hard to be Villanova, if that makes sense.
That's what I was saying all along, that like Neptune shouldn't be making Mark Armstrong and Cam Whitmore playoff jump stops and pivots. You know, those are two of the most athletic guys in the country. Let those guys go.
Yeah. Now, it'll be interesting to see what they do with this group, because I think on one hand, you have the experience and guys will know how to play. Like, Tyler Burton really knows how to play, comes from a Princeton-style offense at Richmond. Obviously, Villanova is not a Princeton look, but some of the cutting and moving without the basketball and, like, just general, like, smart, high IQ plays, that stuff will translate. And then Hart's a veteran who doesn't need the ball in his hands. Like, I don't know that he's like a super high IQ player, but he's not like a low IQ guy either. And then but I really think the sales pitch here is you just have all this size and scoring ability 1 through 4. I mean, very few teams in the country have this level of proven production.
And it seems like Bamba is being a little overlooked. I mean, he put up monster numbers in the Pac-12 last year. He's always shot the cover off the ball. He's got like a little NBA buzz, like a little maybe late second round two-way buzz. But, you know, most people are talking about Moore, Burton, and Dixon. But Bamba's going to give him a ton of firepower in the backcourt.
So, how do you feel about the Moore point guard experiment?
Well, so they're clearly going for this long, versatile, switchable look. Kind of Kenny Payne-esque or NBA-esque, right? I mean, even like you look at their 24 class and they added like three combo forwards / power forwards. So they clearly want like this, you know, a bigger point guard, whether it be Moore or Armstrong. I think it'll work. I mean, Gillespie wasn't a super traditional point guard. And he had a ton of success at Villanova. Moore is a better player than Gillespie was. I guess it could get into that too much ISO back down, but they have more individual talent and individual scoring this year.
So I have Villanova 13th nationally, I believe. Let me confirm that. Yeah, 13th nationally, 4th in the Big East. But we're talking about 6 spots of separation between number 1 and number 4 in this conference. I guess here's my thought. I've seen a lot of Villanova like outside the top 20. To me, if you do not have Villanova as a top 20 team in the preseason, you are basically saying that you don't think Kyle Neptune can coach. And to be clear, I don't believe that that's necessarily like a horrible strategic move ranking teams. But that's what you're saying, right? Like, you don't have to hide around, oh, they don't have a point guard. No, like, you don't think Kyle Neptune can coach. Because if Jay Wright was coaching this team, this would be like a consensus top 5 team national title favorite, in my opinion. Like, why would you rank this team below Kansas in the preseason when Jay Wright was coaching them?
I mean, a lot of people have Justin Moore borderline All-American.
Right.
It seems like everybody has Eric Dixon's like a top 50 player. People have obviously Bamba and Burton as like top 100 players. Hart proven, you know, was a G League camp guy. And, you know, even though you say that if you have Villanova below 20, you say Neptune can't coach. I don't know if I've seen anyone with them outside the top 25. So like I have them 15th. So like we're buying that Neptune steps it up. And for the record, I think Neptune wins Big East Coach of the Year this year. Everyone's saying Pitino. But I think getting Villanova to what I have as a 4 seed, it was a super talented group. I think people will give it to Neptune. But yeah, I mean that's the same argument I've been using for people who don't have Providence top 40. Is you're saying that you think Kim English is a clown. The difference is people are very complimentary of Kim English, but then their ranking suggests otherwise.
That's because they're friends with Kim English.
Right. We're with Neptune. It's kind of like, oh, we'll see. With English, it's like he's a rising star. He's so good, but we'll see, and he's gonna miss the tournament. Where with Neptune, it's like, we'll see. Back of the top 25.
All right, let's move on to Seton Hall. Seton Hall, first year under Shaheen Holloway, probably a little bit disappointing. Missed the NCAA tournament, I think. In the preseason, you would have thought that this team had real NCAA tournament hopes, but the offense just was not good enough. 133rd nationally. Another situation, this team played a lot of ISO ball. It just didn't feel like they had a lot of answers to questions outside of Kadari Richmond and Alamir Dawes putting up jump shots. And that's probably, I mean, Kadari not really jump shots as much as just driving it, although he took a lot of mid-range. But like this was very much like Kadari, Dawes, and Odekale just pounding it. And Defo pounded it. Like it was not a fun basketball game to watch when you turned on Seton Hall last year. And I don't think when you look at the roster that they've really done much to change that, right? I mean, this team is still built around those two guys, but I do think they've gotten even tougher, right? Like they went out and said, all right, Dylan Adaiwusu, the face, I think, him and Posh were the face of the St. John's Heart Not Stars, Grit, Mike Anderson deal. And they grab Adaiwusu to be presumably their starting 3-man. They hope they get some offense out of their 5 spot with Elijah Hutchins Everett, but Jaden Bediako also in that mix. And quite frankly, like, either guy is probably worse than Tyree Samuel. And then these bench guys like Quan Sanders, Jaquan Harris, Isaiah Coleman, maybe they provide some pop, but we don't have enough proof to say for sure that that's the case.
Yeah, so last year I thought Seton Hall would just sneak in. Well, I didn't think Yetno was going to miss the whole year. Yetno's a good player. He's a flawed player. He shoots too many jumpers for his game. He was a reliable, like, 10-5 guy, you feel like, in there. And then when he was out, they were playing Trey Jackson at the 5, which was a disaster. He was getting worked at the 5. He's a 4. He wants to shoot jumpers. They rarely played him and Samuel together.
He's apparently a 3 at Michigan.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know if he handles the ball enough to be a 3, but he's a good player. He's a good, like, 6th, 7th man.
You are a big Trey Jackson defender.
I mean, he's very athletic. He's got great size, and he can really shoot. And for your 5th starter or 6th man, I think that's a decent spot to be in. But back to Seton Hall, I've seen a lot of people suggest that they're going to be bad. And I was actually listening to Lucas Harkins on his pod the other day. He's in agreement with me, not that he knows it. But this Seton Hall team is not going to be bad. They're going to be exactly as good as they were last year. They're going to come in 8th. They're going to make the NIT. You know, they're going to go like 8-12 in the Big East. Their defense is still going to be good, right? Richmond, Wusu, Dre Davis should, you know, Davis is no Casey and Defo at the 4 on the defensive end, but he's still like a physical player, and they'll get mileage at the 5 with Bediako and Hutchins Everett. They'll be a little more physical up front. That'll counteract for the losses of Otakali and Casey and Defo.
I just hope that Sheen Holloway has a little more fun this year.
It seems like he is. He's actually complimentary.
He hated his team so much last year.
He actually gave his team a couple of compliments the other day I saw.
Yeah, that was the one constant. Now, I will say this. You know, we talk about the offense, and it's not been very good on paper. And the other thing that's important to note with the offense, Shaheen was not a good offensive coach at St. Peter's. He got a lot of credit during the NCAA tournament run. But that team was still 231st in offense, and that was with them in the NCAA tournament putting up 1.13 points per possession against Kentucky, 1.1 points per possession against Murray, and then 1.03 against Purdue. But if you go back and you go through that season, there was a lot of stinkers, especially earlier in the season. I mean, 0.7 points per possession versus Ryder. You know, they were not a good offense, and their offense improved in the metrics relatively substantially down the stretch. Before that, he had 3 seasons at St. Peter's, all of which were 300-plus in offense. And then last year, 133, which is pretty ghastly for a high-major team. His teams generally have always turned the ball over. They've been 288 or worse in turnover rate every year. They haven't been top 250 in effective field goal percentage in any of those years. Like, his teams rely entirely upon offensive rebounding, getting to the free throw line. That's how they're going to play. That's how they have to win. And last year, you know, I think there was maybe some hope. Okay, now you give them better players. St. Peter's is only one way to do it, whatever. Wasn't a great first step. So this is a big year for me to see, can Shaheen coach offense?
Yeah, the turnovers were a huge issue last year. And then hopefully Richmond and Dawes playing so much together last year, playing so many minutes, now that they're back. Hopefully Richmond's healthy this year.
Yeah.
And then Dylan Adaiwuzu is one of my favorite players in the Big East these past few years. Such a great glue guy. He'll make some smart passes. He's physical. He can hit a shot. I think he fits in really well with Richmond and Dawes. Sanders could take a jump. He was in the rotation at the very start of the year last year as a freshman, but he was billed as a scorer. See if he can add some pop off the bench.
So I have Seton Hall 8th, 65th nationally.
Yeah, I'm 8th in, I think, mid-50s. Let me pull it up. Sorry. I have them 56. Yeah.
All right, moving on. St. John's. Here we go. This is the discussion we've been waiting for. The Mike Anderson era is over. The style of play that Brad frequently referred to as goofy is no longer. In comes Rick Pitino with 12 new players, coming off a very competitive double overtime scrimmage against Rutgers, which I think if you were looking, first off, it produced the quote of all time, which was, actually, it was good that we didn't win by 20. It was better that we lost in overtime.
I actually have it right here. It's winning by 20 or 25 would have killed my team. Going into double overtime in an exhibition game is a dream come true. I told my team I'd rather have lost than win by 20 because of all the lessons learned in a close game.
It's classic.
You can't trust a word Rick Pitino says. People like fall for this every year. Like literally like 2 days ago, he was saying that Zubi Ejiofor was ahead of Joel Soriano in the rotation. This was like last Friday. And Zubi played like 5 minutes. How much has he talked about like Brady Dunlap is going to play a ton? He barely played. Like
the best way to treat Rick Pitino is to just assume that the opposite of whatever he's saying is true.
Didn't he once say at Iona that he only wanted to be in a league where you could take the bus to games?
Correct. Yeah, he loved the bus. But yes, no. He also says like every time he loses, he wants to jump into the East River. Yeah. And then like he loses. No. We got some lessons out of it. It's okay. But in all seriousness, though, I think some positive signs from that game, right? Danish Jenkins clear was very good. I saw some love for him on Twitter. They played that game without Jordan Dingle and RJ Lewis, two guys I have projected as starters. They held their own, certainly, with a potential tournament team in Rutgers. Trying to still figure out what this rotation looks like. As you said, Ejiofor, all the hype, doesn't really play. Soriano seems like he's still the guy, but... You know, I think the thing you can say confidently with this team is they have experience, they have athleticism, and they have a very, very good coach in Rick Pitino. And is that enough to be a top 25 team? I know you and I disagree on that. I have them just inside. I know you're relatively lower on them, but I think they have enough with these portal guys, with Soriano and with Pitino to say, all right, this is a top 25 caliber team and a top 5 team in the Big East.
Just the whole, like, before they even had a roster together, being like, yes, St. John's top 25 because of Rick Pitino. Like, we are assigning, like, superhuman traits to Rick Pitino and his coaching ability.
I do think it's very funny because, like, everyone put Rick Pitino, like, they put St. John's, like, 23rd in April. And then St. John's proceeded to go get Jordan Dingle, Chris Ledlam, RJ Lewis, retained Joel Soriano, added Simeon Wiltshire. Like every time they added someone, it was like, oh my God, how did he do that? But then they ranked him 23rd at the end of it anyway. It's like we just all decided that they were the 23rd best team in the country and nothing, no matter what, this year.
Right. I was on both Pitino and Cooley all throughout the early portal season where like these guys don't have a plan. Like they're selling people on a master plan. They don't have a plan. Pitino was able to actually figure it out with the late adds of Ledlam and Dingle. Right, they were able to build a pretty good team. Now, I put them 41st. I'm a little wary of these teams that are completely transfer assembled, like we saw last year with LSU. Few other teams that add a bunch of talented pieces, but it's a lot of mid-majors, a lot of mishmash, and the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. I think the one thing maybe I overlooked with the St. John's team is maybe they're a better defensive team than I gave them credit for when evaluating them, but I think I'm comfortable with 41st. It seems like Jenkins has been very good. It seems like Ledlam's been very good. I think Soriano's actually one of the most overrated players in the Big East. Like, I've seen him consistently ranked as, like, a top 50 player. I've seen people have him ahead of Bryce Hopkins, which is absurd. I saw people have him ahead of, I think, Trey Alexander in one as well. Like, he's a good center. His numbers are a little inflated because of the pace.
And he played a ton of minutes.
The breakneck nonsense pace that Mike Anderson played, where everyone had the green light on every shot. And they just they literally torpedoed their season by just taking ridiculous shots. But yeah, maybe I'm not giving the talent level enough credit. But I'm 41st and 6th.
Okay, I'm 24th. I will say with St. John's, one thing I do like before we move on is that I thought Jenkins would be good, but I thought he'd be like game manager. The fact that the early returns are that he can like really be a difference making point guard in this league is a good sign.
And then I'm buying the Nahim Aline stock. He's kind of the forgotten transfer in here. I mean, he was on solid Virginia Tech teams as a starter and a shooter. He just played a pretty good chunk of minutes on the national champion UConn team. I think he's being a little overlooked here in this mid-major heavy class.
Yep. All right, shall we get to Butler? Start really getting into the dregs of this conference?
Dude, Butler last year was literally a bye game.
They were so bad.
I mean, they were pretty good in the non-con when they were just rolling with, like, six guys. Like, Mandy Bates was engaged.
They won all their bye games, and then they beat Kansas State, which, looking back, handling Kansas State is one of the more surprising results of the season.
And kind of much like the Pac-12 conference itself, in the eyes of the TV executives, you know, Chuck Harris, Jaden Taylor, Seamus Lukosius, not very good together, but all apparently have pretty decent value separately.
Oh, see, I actually disagree with you there. I actually thought all three guys were relatively undervalued in the portal.
Because I thought they were overvalued.
No. Hold on. So I'm not sure that any of the three went to a top 50 program and they were all double-figure scorers on a high-major team. That never happens. Every double-digit score on a high-major team is, like, super high.
I guess that's fair. I mean, Glenn Taylor is off to St. John's.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Glenn Taylor was like Ohio State and St. John's and Texas A&M. He's on Oregon State. Like, we're saying that Chuck Harris can't do better than SMU?
I'm not a Chuck. I've never been a Chuck Harris guy.
You hate Chuck. I get that.
Whenever I watch him, he just misses shots.
I will.
He doesn't create. He's very slight. He doesn't play with any power.
I will say, it is remarkable that Butler was 224th in offense last year. That is putrid. Like, that's pathetic.
I think I'm forgetting one of their guards too. Who was the point guard last year?
Oh, geez. If you're listening, Lucas Hawkins, turn it off now. We're about to say a cursed name. Eric Hunter.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Eric Hunter had a horrific year.
I thought he was gonna be okay. Yeah.
He was perfectly fine at Purdue. He never got better. Like, I was like, okay, you know, like, I liked him early in his Purdue career, and then he kind of faded on me. But then, holy cow, he was like his on-offs were horrible last year for Butler.
No, he was a disaster. I thought that was a great pickup when it happened. I was like, yeah, he needs to be let loose of the shackles of Purdue and playing through the post. Like, he's played so many minutes. He's shown some scoring chops in the past. Now he gets to have kind of a resurgence at Butler. I thought that was a great ad. And I was a huge fan of the Mandy Bates ad. But even early season when it was going well, they weren't feeding him enough.
No.
And, you know, between Harris, I mean, Taylor was an okay athlete, but between Harris and Lukosius and Hunter, they just couldn't get anywhere. It was just a lot of jumpers, a lot of missed jumpers. And I can't stress this enough. In the Providence game, it was literally treated as a bye game. Like, Cooley substitution patterns, the score, it was a bye game. And I know Butler lost how many games by 20 points last year. And now they have a completely new roster.
So that's the thing, right? They basically abandoned ship, started over. And if you ask like the average Butler fan, it seems like they think they're going to be like pretty good. Like, I don't know if they're like consensus tournament, but like Butler fans really believe like, okay, the poison of LaVal Jordan is off the program. Thad's got his guys in here. We got all these portalers. We're good to go.
There's no way this team is going to be good.
I agree.
Their best player is Posh Alexander.
Right.
Who was the fourth best player on St. John's last year?
So it's funny because there have been a lot of these like fully new rosters where we said at the time, okay, you know, it feels like they're doing some stuff, right? I think Georgia has been the face of that for this year, right? Where it's like felt like they were doing stuff, but you actually looked up and like the finished product's not very good. Butler, I don't even think you ever thought during the process it felt like they were doing anything. You sort of got there once they got the DJ Davis kid and they got Posh. Like, okay, at least they have this like old backcourt of like proven dudes. But like, this is so underwhelming compared to the rest of the league outside of DePaul.
It seems like their fans are very in on Finley Bizjack.
I think Lucas Harkins is big on Finley Bizjack for sure.
I mean, at least this year, unless they're going to go very small at times, you figure all of Posh, Landon Moore, and DJ Davis are ahead of him. But he's supposed to be a shooter scorer. Maybe he had some pop in his backcourt. Yeah, I'm not super buying a Pierre Brooks. I mean, he was a fringe top 100 guy as a recruit, and he couldn't hack it at Michigan State after a couple of years. It's not like he was a top 50 or something. And it's not like he was at Kentucky or Duke or one of the highest recruiting places.
So I'm very out on Brooks. I'm very low on their center position, the Thomas screen, whatever group you're going to put
Thomas
together.
Thomas isn't bad.
No, but he's, again, Donovan Klingon, Ryan Kalkbrenner,
right.
Sean Nelson, Supreme Cook, Oso Aguadero, Josh Aduro, Elijah Hutchins, Joel Soriano, Eric Dixon, Abu Usman. Is he the ninth best center in the league?
Yeah, I would take him over Supreme Cook, I think. I'd take him over probably the Seton Hall guys, but I kind of buy him Bediako's physicality. Yeah, so yeah, maybe ninth or tenth. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So they have one of the worst bigs in the league. They have a bad three-man. They have a point guard who can't shoot at all. They have a shooting guard who's like 150 pounds, who can really shoot, but I'm not sure he can do anything else. I like Telford a lot.
Me too.
I think the hope should be that Moore and Bizjack really push and get on the floor, be potential building blocks. But yes, I think when you look around, the talent is underwhelming. I think, again, they have to be better than last year, right? So I have them like just outside, just inside the top 100, like 95, and ninth in the Big East. But like, the talent that is one because the Georgetown DePaul group could be pretty rough again, and two because I'm just sort of buying like, all right, Thad Mata is not a shitty coach.
I still have them 10th. With the Masood injury, I'm considering flipping them. I mean, your best player is Posh Alexander. We know what Posh Alexander is. He's like a guy, if like he's your starting point guard and like your fourth best player, you're like, eh.
Maybe he'll be better not playing Mike Anderson ball.
So with more structure.
Yeah.
We could unlock Posh, maybe.
Well, so that's the funny thing. Is on paper, I feel like you'd say Posh was like the perfect Mike Anderson player. Like he's going to get a lot worse without it. But maybe we're wrong. I mean, maybe he winds up being a lot better. I don't know.
And then, Telfort's a guy who I watched a couple of times in high school. I think he was on the team with Caravan, I think.
Yeah, New Hampton School, I believe.
Yeah. And I liked him. I remember saying to you, like, this is a high major player. I don't know what he's doing at Northeastern, but now we'll see how he profiles as a high major player. Again, I mean, I like him, but he doesn't move. None of these guys move the needle. I mean, we talk a lot about, like, okay, this is a team of third best players. This is a team of fifth best players, right? This is a team of, like, sixth or seventh best players.
All right, let's get to our final two teams. Georgetown and DePaul. We'll start with Georgetown. Ed Cooliera ushered in. With that came all this excitement. Oh, they've got this big NIL fund. They're going to get Hunter Dickinson. They're going to get Justin Moore. They're going to do all this. Final result is a lot less exciting. Now, I do think, we said this a lot on the podcast, that Georgetown should have a very bright future, right? We both agree that Cooley's a good coach. We both agree that the recruiting in 2024 and beyond looks very promising. Some of those guys you already see, whether it's Drew Fielder coming in 2023, getting Rowan Brumbaugh as a long-term guy, Jaden Epps, or even some of these high school kids committed like Drew McKenna, who's going to come in mid-year, Thomas Sorber, Kayvon Mulready. Like that's a core that will win in the Big East. But for this year, they've got 9 scholarship guys. One of them's hurt. Ishmael Massoud is going to be out till probably Christmas. One of them's a freshman. One of them's Ryan Mutombo. One of them's Wayne Bristol. Like, they just do not have a lot of bodies here. They're very thin up front. They are very reliant on a guy in Jaden Epps who I think can really score the basketball, but hasn't necessarily proven that he can make winning plays. Like, if he's your best player, who's number two?
Number two, I think the narrative is Jay Heath.
Who is good?
He's been out for the preseason, and I think I saw some quotes like, oh, we really need Jay Heath back. But I mean, Jay Heath was, what, their fourth best player last year on the 7-25 team? But, I mean, he is a double-figure Big East scorer. He can shoot. Overall, they, you know, the die was cast with the roster building. They went too high on guys. I said, you know, once we got the picture of who was recruiting Hunter Dickinson, I said at the moment, like, Cooley has really screwed up. He's going way too high on these guys. Why would Hunter Dickinson go to Georgetown when he can go to literally any school in the country? Those schools have just as much money to pay in NIL. And then they started missing on, like, Russell Chaywa and all these guys. You know, this year is kind of over.
That was the problem, was that after Dickinson, they tried to get in on these, like, panic move guys. But those guys didn't feel respected because they weren't really recruiting them. And they weren't, like, they couldn't really commit NIL-wise because they couldn't take them until Dickinson officially said no.
Right, like, is this even, like, a $300,000 roster?
Yeah, Epps is probably a $300,000 kid.
But certainly not a $3 million roster. Definitely. And they only filled 9 scholarships.
Yeah, but they have a great team of walk-ons.
Right, I guess that they...
Nobody's practice is going to be more efficient than Ed Cooley. He's got 5 walk-ons, like most of whom have like Division I level like playing experience in some form.
I guess they moved up Camp Big Cody to a scholarship guy. I saw the Georgetown blog put up.
8 per game at like Maryland Eastern Shore at one point, I believe.
And if McKenna's coming in mid-year, then they only have 2 left. But that really just shows how the roster was mismanaged from the jump. And I guess they wanted DeMarco Dunn, but he didn't qualify or something. It was just like a comedy of errors. But no matter the path to get here, okay, Cooley at Georgetown is going to be exactly what Cooley at Providence was. They're going to be terrible this year. Next year, they're going to like just miss the NCAA tournament. And then he's just going to collect 7-10 seeds. And he'll make like one Sweet 16. And then he'll go and call games for Fox Sports 1.
He'll do that for like 10 years. Just as everyone's getting like kind of annoyed, he'll retire. And then Georgetown will have to like see if they actually care about trying to win championships or not.
Which I think every Georgetown fan would probably take that. I've seen some, like, wait, this guy's making $6 million, blah, blah, blah. But, like, at the end of the day, like, if you're making the tournament after not making it for so long, you're probably going to be pretty cool with that. But on this year's roster, I mean, I logged the take a couple months ago that Jaden Epps would lead the Big East in scoring. I'm already patting myself on the back for that.
I think regardless of whether it happens, it was good process.
Drew Fielder. I've watched a lot of Drew Fielder, given he was a Providence recruit at one point. He was on the same team as Garway, so I was getting both watches in at once. Drew Fielder is more of a prospect than you would think. Like, I don't mean like NBA prospect. I mean like in a prospect versus player. Like, you would think he's more of a player, given his archetype. But he's
being
got a...
white?
No, but being like kind of the Luka Garza, you know, the skilled big. But the skills are not put together yet. Like, he floats a lot. He can shoot, he can score inside, but like he'll score like 8 points in a game when like he should have like 20. And then he plays no defense. Like, literally no defense. It was like pitiful watching him play defense. He has immense upside to be like a Luka Garza level scorer. I don't know if he's gonna put it all together. But he's a good take, and it seems with the Masud injury, he's going to play a ton. Overall, I guess I like them more than Butler because they have more top-end talent. And I think Cooley is, in the year 2023, Cooley's a better coach than Mata, I think. But I'm not putting Georgetown in my top 100.
Neither am I. I'm 124th nationally, 10th in the Big East.
And, I mean, we've heard nothing about Dontrezl Stiles.
It's true.
I figured he'd be a big piece. I presume he's starting, given Masud is out as well. And, you know, I've heard a little, you know, from like Georgetown fans and tweets about Rowan Brumbaugh being good. About it. Obviously Epps, Heath, Fielder. I haven't heard a peep about Stiles. But anyway, does that move us to DePaul?
Yeah, let's wrap it up. Bring it home with DePaul. The Blue Demons had a, I would say, promising first year under Stubblefield. Year two, a lot shakier, right? Like, I don't think they took the steps forward you would have hoped. Part of that was you lose David Jones to the portal. Obviously, Freeman Liberty to the pros were two huge pieces. But, you know, injuries didn't help. But the fight that was so clearly on display in year one just didn't feel like it was there night to night. They had some good games, but just consistency-wise, it wasn't there. 23-loss campaign sets up, I would say, a warm seat year three for Stubblefield. They're investing in the program. You know, they have a new practice facility on the way. You know, it may not be comfortable, and I know that there aren't necessarily big reasons on paper for huge excitement with this team. I know Deshaun Nelson back. Seems like they think he's going to have a big year. He was like 14-7 down the stretch after being a 10-5 guy overall. But I think you just look around at the transfers that they've added, and it's pretty underwhelming compared to the rest of the league. And part of that's, I'm sure, NIL and whatnot. But Elijah Fisher, Jeremiah Oden, Chico Carter, and Jaden Henley doesn't quite hit the same as some of the other groups that added. And that is the central challenge of being at DePaul, right? Tony Stubblefield is a good recruiter. He got them in the mix with Arterio Morris, right? He obviously did well at Oregon. He's gotten some good players at DePaul. But you're never going to approach DePaul from a talent advantage, right? DePaul is never going to be more talented than a team than other teams of the Big East. At least it's going to take like 5 years to do it because you're going to need to win and win and win. You're early in your tenure, you're going to have to win with teams that on paper are worse than their opponent. And I don't see how Tony Stubblefield gets to that point.
I mean, it's kind of crazy how they just can never break through. Like, they had the 1 year where they were pretty close.
You know, with Paul, and they had multiple NBA players
on the same team. But, you know, they seemingly are always producing pretty talented guys. They're like usually not the least talented team in the conference. There's usually one or two teams that you say, okay, DePaul's got a better roster than them. And I think this year I'd probably take DePaul's roster over Butler's. Maybe Georgetown. Probably Georgetown.
Marginally I like DePaul's, but I like Thad and Cooley over Stubbs.
And, you know, I really liked what we saw from Jaden Henley last year at Minnesota. He's got great size. He has great upside. You know, can hit shots, can play off the dribble. Elijah Fisher had a nice U19 with Canada. We'll see if he can have a bounce back year. He was a reclass guy who got lost at Texas Tech. Jalen Terry, I've seen flashes from, but I haven't put together. I know people, and I think the analytics hate Caleb Murphy. We'll see as a year two or three transfer how that goes. Nelson had a good year last year. He can really score. Good athlete. Jeremiah Odom was a nice shooter at Wyoming. But overall, again, I mean, we're saying your best player is Elijah Fisher or Deshaun Nelson. That's just not going to live up to the rest of the conference.
Yeah.
And then there's, like, literally a DePaul curse where, like, literally, I don't think that they've made the NCAA tournament since being in the Big East, like, 17 years or whatever. It's been 18 years. I don't know how DePaul fans keep going.
What do we define as a win this year for DePaul? Like, if you're looking to decide, do we want Stubblefield to keep his job? What are you looking for?
NIT.
Wow.
Need some tangible process here. Progress, excuse me.
But again, and that's the problem, right? It's like, if you're DePaul, you could step forward and get to like 500 and miss the NIT this year. And that would feel like a win, right? You went for 23 losses to the NIT, but then you're going to lose multiple of these guys. I think Nelson might have a COVID year.
Yeah, he does. The only guy who they definitely lose, I think, is Chico Carter.
Yes, Chico has to go. But who knows? If they have a good year, Nelson will be a potential portal watch.
Yeah.
Odin, I believe, has to go.
Oh, I thought Verbal's had Odin with...
Maybe I'm wrong. I thought he had. This is it. But you need some of these young guys to start to show it. I know they're excited about Churchill Abbas, who's just like a massive, big guy from NBA Academy. But I need to see some like longer term pieces emerging here to feel confident in a year four for Stubbs.
So if DePaul comes in last, like I think we both have, right?
Yep.
Gotta fire Stubblefield.
Probably.
Enough fooling around. Who's your next coach at DePaul?
Richard Pitino.
You think that Richard's the guy to move the needle, or you just want to build on these Big East storylines?
Yes. I actually think he'd do a good job there. I think the Minnesota tenure, based on the Ben Johnson Minnesota tenure, looks a little better now. I think, you know, he wouldn't necessarily recruit Chicago, but he has some credibility to recruit nationally, has good relationships. Obviously, the storyline would be great. I think it makes some sense. If things go south for Porter Mosier at Oklahoma, that would be an option. Again, I think like Porter makes sense because he's a guy who can elevate middling talent. Like, maybe it won't work, right? Like, I'm not going to be like, oh my God, Porter Mosier is the best coach of all time, right? Like, obviously, he hasn't done a great job at Oklahoma yet, but like, Porter trying to coach DePaul, like trying to coach at DePaul would make a lot more sense than Porter trying to coach at Oklahoma right now. And I think Porter's style would fit much more like trying to win in the Big East than in the Big 12.
I mean, if we're all in on getting a ball coach, Kyle Smith with a decent Washington State year?
We might have to get that's the problem, though, is you need like a ball coach who has some like shit to him. Like, you need like you can't just hire some rando. Like, it has to be someone who like kind of fits and can be in Chicago, and like, it's hard.
See, I'm completely selling all of the geographical ties for anything. Like, oh, you got to recruit the DMV at Georgetown, or oh, you got to recruit Chicago at DePaul, or Atlanta at Georgia. Mm-hmm. Like, you can get players from wherever you want. Like, probably the most discussed one recently was, oh, Mike Anderson can't do it in New York City. Like, Mike Anderson failed because their team didn't value possession.
Played a stupid. Well, no, like, it's funny. Mike Anderson's better in New York City than anyone would have anticipated. He developed an NBA player in Champagne.
Right, like we were joking about Hard Knock Stars, and then like Julian Champagne, who he was talking about, was like an absolute monster.
And both Posh and Adai Wusu probably overachieved recruiting ranking. Soriano was a city kid that they took as a transfer, and he overachieved. Like pretty much all the New York City kids they took overachieved.
Yeah, like they had good. I mean, even the weird COVID year where there were no fans. Like, they were lined up to make the NCAA tournament, and they just kind of faltered down the stretch.
Right. They don't value possessions.
I mean, like, even looking at their roster last year, like, David Jones was a huge get. AJ Store was good last year. Mathis was kind of whatever, but, like, they got good players. The year before, yeah, they had Aaron Wheeler was awesome for them. Champagne, yeah. They got guys.
All right, so big picture. Probably only hot seat in the league this year is Stubbs, right? Could maybe get hot for Neptune quickly if they underachieve.
Oh, but I don't think they'd fire they miss a tournament. They got to pull the plug.
I would tend to agree, but I'm not sure they would.
Right, we both have them top 15.
Yes.
Any chance that Thad Mata just bails, or do you think that...
I think there's a chance of that. I think they suck.
I mean, they have enough. Right, the only guy that they lose off this team is Jalen Thomas, right?
Yes. DJ Davis, I thought. Maybe I'm wrong.
Like, Verbals had Davis with another year, but I mean, is anyone fact checking Verbals here with some of these? But
no. DJ Davis has up to 2 years.
Right. So. Butler could bring everyone back except for Jalen Thomas. Maybe if this year goes bad, that gives it one more go around to see if the core that he built here can keep it moving. But
the interesting thing with Butler is the expectations and reality are completely like disjointed. Like from an NIL standpoint, Butler is much closer to DePaul. Like, every fundamental about Butler other than history makes Butler DePaul with a unique gymnasium.
So why? Right? And, you know, we were talking about the Temple one earlier where Temple has, like, literally no NIL money. And it's like, well, Temple was pretty good pretty recently. Like, it's not that long ago that, like, Fran Dunphy had them in the tournament seemingly every year. Butler, even higher level than that.
The easiest explanation I've been given is that Butler has essentially operated like a well-resourced mid-major program forever. And Butler did that, went to a national championship game, multiple national championship games, lost Brad Stevens to the NBA, hired the Brandon Miller guy.
Yeah.
He had to bounce before it went bad. So then they just hired Chris Holtman, and Chris Holtman, again, did remarkable things. But the financial race in college sports has really been heating up. Butler hasn't even been engaging in the game, and they were already behind. So now they're doubly behind. They're not like a huge donor-rich community, right? I mean, it's kind of a... It's not like Villanova has much more like wealthy alumni than Butler does. And Butler doesn't quite understand like in its community, whether it be its donors, its AD, who's been criticized plenty, Barry Collier. Like there is no understanding like, OK, the Butler way doesn't work or the Butler way won't work. You can't count on it. Right. Like, and maybe Thad failing would do that. But we don't know for sure.
Yeah, because, I mean, Butler looks to be in a rough spot. I mean, they...
I will be very interested to see, and again, because they didn't do a search last time, we don't really know what the interest was. Thad got the job. If it opens again, I'm sure they will talk to Ronald Norred because he will be the Butler family guy. But after that, like, I'm very curious who wants that job. Like, I do not foresee, like, a Nico Medved, like, that level of candidate, right? Like, that high-end mid-plus coach, Mountain West, A-10. I do not think those guys are going to want Butler. Like, I'll use the backyard example. Like, if Loyola or Butler right now, I'd rather be at Loyola.
What about, like, Ron Hunter?
Coming back to Indianapolis?
Yeah.
I don't think, like, that's a Butler guy, if that makes sense.
That stuff is so stupid.
I mean, the
LaVal Jordan hire was absolutely absurd. He had, like, one bad year at UW-Milwaukee. They hired him because he's a former player.
He was asinine, yeah.
And he ran it right into the ground. And he could. And now maybe I'll be saying the same thing about Providence. Who knows? But even when things were going well for Butler, I was always surprised at the level of recruits that they were pulling. And even when they were like a top 25 team, like with Holtman and that early LaVal, they were like only getting like guys ranked in like the 180s and 200s. And I was always surprised by that. And you find out, probably has something to do with recruiting budget or God knows what.
Yeah, I remember like their hugely hyped class was like Jacoby Coles and Scooby Johnson. And it was like, wow, like yeah. Butler got a few like fringe top 150 guys. Whoa.
Yeah, like the same class as like old Dominion's putting together now.
Yeah. But anyway, big picture, I think the league's gonna be great at the top, be weak at the bottom. Lots of storylines, lots of fun. Can't wait for it, Brad. Can you?
I literally cannot wait. I'm dying over here. I mean, freaking Kim English, okay? With his secrecy. He didn't post any of the overseas games, just like a 3-minute highlight video for each. Two secret scrimmages, and supposedly he doesn't want any of the info getting out. With this, so no one can see their game plan or whatever. They better beat Columbia on November 6th by 90. Like, you don't want to post the game against the Spanish All-Stars in the middle of August? Like, what insight are people going to get from that that's going to hurt you this season?
Remember, it's Kim English's brain versus the rest of the country, and his brain is telling him not to reveal such secrets.
Is he going to call Fox Sports 1 on Monday the 6th and tell him to
no television.
Skip over Providence in the whip around so no one can see him?
No film. No film.
I just want some content.
Anyway, well, we will wrap it up. We'll see you all next week with our prop bets episode. Big episode every year. Thanks for listening, guys.